Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ana Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly brings us one part in an ongoing series about America's former presidents. But first, the Higher Education Report.
Generations of people in the United States have seen higher education as the best path towards a well-paying and satisfying job. But the cost of attending colleges and universities in the country has increased greatly over the last 30 years. And there is no guarantee that earning a degree will lead to a job that pays a person enough to support a family. So some people turn to other forms of education and training. These include programs that lead to certifications and other documentation that prove a person's abilities in a given field, from construction to healthcare. These kinds of programs often cost less than traditional degree programs, and they usually take less time to complete. Employers may still choose traditional degree holders for top positions, but there are still many well-paying jobs that require a specialized kind of knowledge that certification programs provide. New research, however, suggests that these programs are not helping women as much as they are helping men. In 2016, the U.S. Department of Education began collecting data on work experience and non-degree credential programs. The department released the final results of its research earlier this year.
It found that about 27% of adults in the country hold at least one of these credentials. Adults who had one of these non-degree credentials made more money and were more likely to be employed than those who did not. Yet the public policy research group, New America, found some troubling information within that data. Experts there found that men and women earn these credentials at about the same rate. But men who have the same credentials as women are more likely to be employed. They also make more money. For example, 74% of men with a certificate but no 4-year college degree were employed. By comparison, 67% of women with a certificate but no 4-year degree were employed. In terms of pay, 46% of women with a credential but no 4-year degree made less than $30,000 a year. The same was true for 25% of men, New America found. 17% of men with only a non-degree credential earned more than $75,000. Just 5% of women with similar credentials earned that much. New America released its report in September. Lal Tesfai is a leading policy expert at New America's Center on Education and Skills, and she helped write the group's report. She argues that these differences in employment levels and pay are due, in part, to existing gender divisions in some industries.
The report found that some industries are either male or female dominated, meaning 70% or more of the workers are of one gender. For example, engineering and computer security are male-dominated fields. Office support jobs are female-dominated. The report also found that non-degree credential holders in male-dominated fields earn more money. TESFI suggests that women are more likely to enter fields that are lower paying because of cultural influences. She says young men are often pushed into careers that value independence, leadership skills, or even physical strength. She says society tells young women they are responsible for supporting others instead of working towards their own goals. TESFI told VOA, "It's no coincidence that some of the female-dominated occupations are care occupations, like healthcare and education." Karen Dove is the executive director of Apprenticeship and Non-Traditional Employment for Women. Her nonprofit organization trains and supports women entering construction, repair, and other building trades. Dove says that in some of the better-paying, male-dominated industries, women face a workplace culture that is not very welcoming. She says that on many construction sites, for example, male workers share a tradition of offensive humor and sometimes disrespectful behavior. Sexual harassment is common. And in several cases, male workers have sexually assaulted the female workers. These are things that are still happening on these construction sites, said Dove. Even if women enter the construction industry, they're more likely to drop out because of this type of culture that exists.
Ben Williams is Chief Executive Officer of the National Alliance for Partnerships in Equity. The organization supports equality in education and employment. He says New America's findings present serious problems. Experts and educators often push these non-degree programs as alternatives to college, he explains. He says that experts may tell women that credential programs offer them a chance to pay less and possibly earn more in the future. But if women in general are not getting the same results as men, they need to be told that too, Williams says. Otherwise, they may not be making the best or most informed decisions for their financial future by choosing these programs. A lot of these jobs that we're talking about lead to family-sustaining wages, Williams said. And so, if women are not accessing those occupations that lead to family-sustaining wages, it not only affects them, it affects their family. Williams and TESFI agree that the first step to making sure the outcomes of these credential programs are more equal is messaging. Educators need to send messages to women and girls that any occupation is open to them, not just ones where they serve the needs of others. Dove says the efforts cannot stop there. Both she and Williams note that employers must also do their part. Williams argues that businesses must take note of how they may unfairly consider the abilities of men and women when filling positions. Dove adds that if offensive behavior is taking place on a job site, employers need to break with tradition and remove those involved. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Food expressions are popular with language learners. They combine two things important to every culture, food and language.
Today, we are going to talk about spuds, a nickname for potatoes. First of all, potatoes have been around for a very long time. In the food magazine Bon Appetit, Sam Dean writes about the beginnings of the potato. He explains that the common white potato came from Peru at least 7,000 years ago. Potatoes fed the Incan Empire and other cultures in Peru at that time.
These days, most countries use a type of potato in their cooking. Whether you like them boiled, baked, mashed, or fried, potatoes are what we call a staple. This means they are a basic food that you can build on. You can cover them in gravy, butter, salt and pepper, or sour cream and herbs. And for people who eat pork, you have not lived until you have eaten a baked potato topped with melted cheese and crispy bacon. Mmm, yum.
Speaking of meat on top of potatoes, let's go back to the idea of potatoes being a simple, basic food. We have a potato expression to describe a person like that. Simple, basic, common. If someone is a meat and potatoes kind of person, they prefer eating simple meals, such as, well, meat and potatoes. They are not interested in complex, fancy food. They are unpretentious.
Men are often described by this expression. When I hear about a meat and potatoes man, I picture a big, beefy guy. He likes to wear blue jeans and a simple t-shirt. He probably drives a truck and can fix it himself. He is a simple, no-nonsense kind of guy.
I like my steak well done. Taters fried, football games on Monday night. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man.
It is a little less common, but we can also describe a woman as a meat and potatoes kind of person. This type of woman not only likes to eat steak and hamburgers, she is also a down-to-earth person. She likes simple things, can take care of herself, and is comfortable just hanging out with the guys. Besides describing people, there is another way we use meat and potatoes. It can also describe the most important part of an activity or event.
For example, you might say that order is the meat and potatoes of teaching children. A teacher cannot teach, and the children cannot learn, in a loud, wild, messy classroom. Now, order may not be the most exciting part of teaching little ones, but it is arguably the most important, or the meat and potatoes. In another example, you could say that voter outreach is the meat and potatoes of any political campaign. If people don't come out to vote for your candidate or issue, the rest of your campaign strategy really does not matter.
Okay. As you know, potatoes hold heat well, meaning they stay hot for a long time. This idea led to the hot potato party game. Here's how you play. Players form a circle and toss a small object quickly to each other while music plays. You want to release the object as fast as possible, as if it was a hot potato. When the music stops, the player holding the potato must leave the game.
However, hot potato is more than a game. It can also mean a divisive or difficult issue. So you could say the lawmakers discussed a few hot potato issues at the meeting. And if an issue is too controversial, it might be a good idea to drop it like a hot potato. When you drop something or someone like a hot potato, you leave the person or thing completely and quickly. Take my friend Olga, for example. She was dating this guy for a few months, and she really liked him. But when she saw him acting unkind to a little puppy, she dropped him like a hot potato. You see, Olga loves animals, especially dogs.
Hot potatoes might be important issues, but small potatoes are just the opposite. They are unimportant matters. We often use the term small potatoes when we dismiss something. It is simply not worth our time.
Again, my friend Olga can help explain. After a storm damaged her hometown, she decided to collect money for homeless animals. She had little time to do so. There were so many cats and dogs without any food or shelter. To help, I suggested selling lemonade to raise some money. "Small potatoes," she cried. "We need to go for big business donors. They have real money to spend."
People can also be called small potatoes. It is a way of saying they are not a threat. If police in a big city do not have enough resources, they probably won't waste manpower on small potatoes, like bicycle thieves. They have bigger fish to fry. But please note, we may say small potatoes for trivial, unimportant matters.
But we do not say big potatoes for important ones. English is funny that way. And that's Words and Their Stories.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo. VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Herbert Hoover. He took office in 1929. Hoover was president for the early years of what Americans call the Great Depression. During those years, the United States economy slid into a severe recession. Many banks and businesses failed. At times, nearly one in four people in the U.S. workforce were unemployed. Millions of people lost their homes and savings. Hoover did not cause the Depression. The conditions had been in place before he took office. But many Americans blamed Hoover for their suffering. They believed he permitted the economic crisis to continue and even deepen during his time in office. Herbert Hoover was born in a small house in the state of Iowa. His parents were Quakers. Their religion valued simplicity, hard work, equality among people, and peaceful resolution of conflict. Hoover and his brother and sister were influenced by these beliefs, even after their parents died. By the time young Herbert Hoover was 9, he was an orphan. He moved to the state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest
and lived with an uncle. Hoover did not thrive in that situation. Reports say that he usually kept to himself, and he did not do particularly well in school. Yet one official from Stanford University liked what he saw in the young man: hard work and a desire to learn new things. At the time, Stanford University was just getting established. It admitted Hoover into its first class. Hoover had to work hard at Stanford, both in class and to earn money to pay tuition. But the experience brought many benefits. Hoover studied geology and went on to work as a mining engineer. The job led to positions in Australia, China, and other parts of the world. He became an internationally known expert on mining. He also wrote a leading textbook on mining. These experiences, along with good business investments, led to great wealth for Hoover. At Stanford, he also met the woman who would become his wife. Her name was Lou Henry. She was the first woman from Stanford to complete a study program with a degree in geology. The Hoovers went on to have two sons. During World War I, the Hoovers' lives changed dramatically. The family was living in London when the war began. U.S. government officials asked Hoover to organize an evacuation effort for American tourists who were in Europe. In only a few weeks, Hoover's committee succeeded. Later, he helped get food and supplies to people in Belgium. As a result, Hoover earned a public image as a smart, skilled humanitarian. When the United States entered World War I, President Woodrow Wilson asked Hoover to lead the government's Food Administration. In that position, Hoover led an effort to change Americans' behavior in order to support the war effort. He asked them to limit the kinds of food they ate and goods they bought. The effort was, for the most part, successful. Americans called their moves to limit their consumption to Hooverize. Hoover went on to organize programs to aid other countries, including Russia. He also helped parts of the U.S. recover after terrible flooding. And as Secretary of Commerce, he pushed businesses, researchers, and government officials to work together. Hoover aimed to reduce boom and bust cycles and keep the U.S. economy healthy. In all his efforts, Hoover urged Americans to choose to participate. He did not believe in using government requirements to force cooperation. Instead, he supported individualism, the idea that Americans must protect the qualities of creativity, equal opportunity, and service to others. Hoover's beliefs were popular with many Americans at the time, and with many Americans today. In the election of 1928, Hoover easily won the presidency. He promised to continue leading the country down the path of prosperity. When Hoover took office in 1929, he said, "I have no fears for the future of our country. It is bright with hope." That was in March. In October, the U.S. stock market crashed. Thousands of investors lost their savings. The event was part of a sharp downturn in the economies of the United States and of many other countries. At first, Hoover believed the downturn would pass. But as time went on, the situation grew worse. Businesses could not expand their workforce. Farmers could not afford to harvest their crops. Everyday people had too little money to pay for housing costs and, in some cases, food. And then banks across the country began to fail. President Hoover worked hard to fix the problems. He tried many approaches, creating government agencies, urging private and public groups to cooperate, and working to balance the federal budget. But Hoover did not want to use federal money to provide direct aid to Americans. He worried that such actions would make people dependent on the government and reduce people's individual power and morale. Nor did he want to use the federal government to try to control the economy. Government intervention, he said, would lead to socialism and eventually destroy the country's founding beliefs. Instead, Hoover tried to support states and businesses indirectly and urged people to find ways to help one another. Yet many lawmakers and members of the public rejected Hoover's measures as insufficient and even cruel. Some used his name differently than they had before he took office. Now, they called the dirty shelters where hungry and homeless people lived Hoovervilles, and they called men's empty pockets Hoover flags. Although Hoover tried to persuade Americans that he was protecting their interests in the long run, voters refused to elect him for a second term. Instead, they overwhelmingly chose a president who promised an activist federal government and a hopeful New Deal for Americans. After they left the White House, the Hoovers retired to their home in Palo Alto, California. Lew Henry Hoover died in 1944, but Hoover lived 20 more years, many of them working for the public good. He helped international relief efforts, advised the U.S. government, and led committees to reform the presidency. Hoover also commented on later presidents and their policy decisions. He was especially critical of government programs set up to provide aid and intervention in Americans' lives. Until his death from cancer at the age of 90, Hoover remained committed to his beliefs. He spoke for limiting the power of the federal government and for supporting freedom of opportunity for individuals. But in the eyes of many Americans, Hoover is linked to the failure of the federal government to lessen the Great Depression. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.